Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to Home Health QIO National Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions, and those instructions will be given to you at that time. If you should require assistance during the call, please press star, then zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to our host, Ms. Eve Eslinger. Please go ahead.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the QIO National Call. And we have a few updates today. It's really a rather short call, but then we are going to have a WebEx that we'll be showing, and we'll discuss that at the point that we come to it. To begin with, I'd like to introduce our Director of Scientific Support, Jill Manna, and she's going to be giving you an update on QIO reports. Jill?
Hello, everyone. I just wanted to let you know that the reports have been updated to your accounts, to your QNET accounts. So take a look at them, and if you have any questions, please give us a contact. Let us know.
Okay. Thanks, Jill. And just so you all know that with Sean leaving about 2 or 3 weeks ago, Jill will be overseeing that the reports are sent. Actually, someone else is sending them, but Jill's over that, making sure that they're sent out. And if you have any questions, certainly contact myself or Jill, and we'll make sure that those get answered. The second piece that we're going to spend a little time on was an additional handout, and I think that before I go there, I meant to say that this call is being handled as a WebEx, obviously, so you can see the WebEx later. At this point, we just have the agenda on the screen. But as a handout that was part of the call was something called Polish Your Practice Series. And this is a listing of new, some old, and some very current WebExes and resources that we are developing for the home health community. And we are developing in that we're not actually doing all of them, as you very well see. We're employing consultants and others to do these. But really, to give you more details, Misty Kevich is with us. I'm going to ask her to kind of elaborate and share with you the idea behind this Polish Your Practice series. Misty?
Thanks, Eve. Well, since the campaign's behind us, we had to come up with something else to do. You know how we are here at the kiosk. No, seriously, what we did is, prior to the campaign, we really spent a lot of time in finding the best of the resources, what we needed for home care to really help our agencies be independent and work at their agencies in improving their outcomes. And then the campaign, we really focused in on those 12 interventions and on those BPIPs and in promoting the acute care hospitalization. So now as the campaign, which has concluded officially, but we know that the campaign really is going to be continuing for a long period of time. There's plenty of materials in those 12 BPIPs alone. But what else is missing out there that we really had not a lot of resources to really help our home health agencies be independent in being able to take the best of the best resources or take templates that were created, and be able to utilize those at their agency? So some of the areas that we found that were in need of some additional resources are what you're going to see laid out as some of our plans that we're continuing to work on here at the kiosk. The first thing is we're doing a whole series on heart failure, and what this is going to do is expound upon the disease management BPAP. We're taking the heart failure a little bit further. We have an excellent presenter, this Ms. Vera Barton Caro, who's doing actually some sessions for us in Pennsylvania, and she's phenomenal. She is a nurse practitioner. She is in an outpatient cardiac clinic. She has started her doctorate work. She's really very good. So what we have contracted with her is we are doing 3 WebExes, but there will be 3 modules that will be for clinicians, and that's on the current guidelines and therapy in managing heart failure patients. It's very, very good. I think I've now sat through 6 or 7 sessions, either live or recorded sessions with her, and I continue to learn from her immensely. But to kind of correlate with that, there were still some missing elements. So what we've done is we've recorded Dr. Carl Ohringer from Case Western University, and that's what we're going to hear his WebEx today. I just IFMC just finished it for us at the very end of the week last week, so we wanted to go ahead and give you a shot of being able to see that and hear that today. It's like about a half an hour presentation, which is going to be on lipid management. So that ties so nicely together for our clinicians in home care. Then also we've asked a professor at the Temple University who's preparing. We have not recorded her yet, but we have that set to occur beginning of May on the pharmacological interventions. And what I've done is we've given her a list of medications that Vera talks about or Dr. Ohringer talks about and some additional medications that she's going to address as well so that we can tie these segments together on the current treatment trends in heart failure for patients. We also have a professor at the University of Pennsylvania who is going to be recording a nutritional intervention, a little to talk about cardiac as well as lipid management of our diets for our patients and helping us to get our patients to be more compliant. So that's kind of like a really a nice, wonderful 6-part series for heart failure that you're going to be able to promote. We'll have all of those. That whole package will be available on MedQuick beginning of June that they're going to be able to utilize however they would like to. We broke the clinician pieces into 3 modules to make it a little more user-friendly in an agency so it's not so time. They can bring them in for a staff meeting and do 1 module and then the second. So technically, if the agency wants to look at that, that's a 6-module unit that they could do every other month. That would be a year's worth of heart failure education for them. The other areas that we thought really needed a little bit more resources would be wound management. So we have recorded management of surgical wounds. We had Laurie on one of our COP calls recently on the wound management, and Eve contacted her to just change it up a little bit so it was very focused more to the clinician, the home care clinician. So that was recorded last week, and that will be available. We'll notify you on the listserv when that's available that you can start notifying your agency. And we are in the process of setting up another speaker to do one on decubitus management. Again, we felt that we still needed to be able to offer some presentations on these two topics that do cause a lot of admissions to hospitalization. So we'll be able to take care of that for wound management. With diabetes, we're still working with a couple options for our speakers here, but we're going to definitely look at current guidelines in therapy and also on promoting self-management through diabetes. So we'll get back to you and give you a little bit of more information you'll see as we announce that little series as well. Data analysis. We know for our agencies, they have a lot of turnover, even at the QI lead level, but also in the clerical level, whoever might be addressing the data analysis. And so that was definitely an area we knew we needed to capture. So we have a session on CASPER Reports 101 that Eve is going to record in a week or two. And what we're going to do is basically how do you get the report, literally step-by-step with screenshots from their end, what they see at their at a home health agency, how to get in and get the reports. And then what does it mean, the basics. So we'd have a nice recording there. Sean had previously did an Everything You Never or Ever Wanted to Know About OBQI Outcome and Risk-Adjusted Data. So that's already recorded, but we're going to kind of put this together as a series. So a very much a beginning level, a little more advanced in how to interpret the data. And we are also working on creating some accompanying guides and resources, and we thank the QIOs that are helping us with that as well. You heard last week, I believe, that our health literacy session that was done by Paul Smith with Excellence. We have that recorded, and we're going to be making that available for our home health agencies, too. Because as QIOs, we have created a lot of materials for our agencies, and keeping health literacy in mind is important, and keeping it to a fourth, fifth grade level is something that we do on a routine basis. But home care agencies do revise forms, make their own forms. So we think that this is an important series that we will offer and make available for the home health agencies as well. So working with Medicare Advantage plans, again, nothing new. That was two PowerPoints that were created. One was the Medicare Home Health Services, the basics, and that was just on what is conditions of participation, what is homebound status, what is the requirements for a patient to be on home care. And the second one was Home Health and Medicare Advantage working together to improve patient outcomes. And that was really how to work with your QIO, how a managed care organization, can work with their home health agencies, and what a QIO is, and what it means to working on a plan of action. What did it mean to work with the home health campaign and the 12 best practice intervention packages? Well, they're still all very relevant. Some states have been using those. There are some states that are higher HMOs in managed care. Pennsylvania is one of those states, and we've done numerous presentations live at some of our managed care organizations, and we've gotten very positive feedback, not only from the organization we've presented to, but agencies that are working with that organization. They feel that they, now when they're asking for front-loading visits, the organization, it is filtering down. They do understand what front-loading visits are now, and they're not having as much difficulty in getting those visits. So we've used it in Pennsylvania live. We also had recorded it as a Pennsylvania and put it on our website. Each state, as a QIO, you have that option to do whatever you would like to do, but we felt it would be valuable to go ahead and re-record these from the kiosk to make those available for home care agencies. So if they may want to direct one of their HMOs to a site and say, hey, there are some resources there, that is something, we'll ask for you to promote, and we're going to include on a list I'll tell you about here in a few minutes. The chronic care model, again, we all heard Dr. Ed Wagner back in December, I believe, on one of our national combined COP call. We went ahead and recorded him again in the very end of January. We're keeping in mind home health clinicians as the audience. And so that recording is already posted on MedQuick, but we think that's going to be important so that leadership and clinicians really do have a better understanding of the emphasis of the chronic care model. We're going to see such a lot more coming out of his chronic care model, expanding beyond just the physician offices as we go forward in the next few years. And then the best practices for reducing ACH, the campaign materials. Those 12 packages, we ask agencies to come in, take a look at those, pick out a couple action items to work on each month. The point is then to go back. Our tips of the week right now are supporting that and going back, taking a look. Now it's time to reevaluate or take a look at some of the action items or go back and reread. As you're working with agencies, you're probably all doing, and I did it today with several of the agencies I talked with, as we talk about their current problems that they've identified or we identified together in our call, then directing them back to, how about rereading a section in this best practice intervention package? Your answers are really there. It's just we've been helping to support them in knowing where to go find them. So we really want to continue to emphasize those packages are current. They have the most evidence-based and the most current guidelines and practices in place. So they're still going to be current for a while. And again, we're really trying to make our agencies as independent as possible. So what we're going to do, this is a beginning list, but we are going to add a few more resources here, some that are already developed, that have been on MedQuick, things that we think are key tools, that key resources that agencies are going to need as they go forward. and make this kind of a toolbox template, a form that's going to have some key tools that they have one document that we will promote that they can go and everything will be hyperlinked. It will have a description of what it is and the link will take you directly to where it's posted on MedQuick. So it would be easy access. If they identify a problem, say 6 months from now, and they can take a look at this resource and say, maybe I need to take a look at that Detubitus Management WebEx that's on this list. And yeah, you know what? Maybe I need to show that during my next staff meeting. We've had an increase in wounds going into the hospital. We're having a deteriorating in their wound status. So the idea is to try to independently link their resources for them on one simple tool. So this is our starting point that we're working from. And if you see some other big areas of need that we haven't identified yet, please contact Eve or myself. We're again trying to find the holes that might be missing on MedQuick. We're trying to just kind of solidify our resources and making sure that we have covered all the bases up and beyond the campaign. And that's everything, I believe, Eve.
Well, thanks, Misty. As Misty said, we'll have that toolbox available, and we are working with several QIOs to develop some of these additional resources. So we appreciate all of you for supporting us, getting the word out there about these additional resources, and certainly helping us in some instances. At this time, Operator Star, I'd like to open for questions and or have a Q&A session because after the Q&A session, just so you all know, we'll be starting the WebEx. So, Operator, if you could open the line for questions.
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. You'll hear a tone indicating you have been placed in queue. You may remove yourself from queue at any time by pressing the pound key. If you're using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, please press star followed by one at this time. One moment, please, for our first question. And we don't have any questions at this time. Please continue.
Okay, actually, Star, if you don't mind, we'll just wait a minute or two because
certainly.
Once we start the WebEx, it'll be hard, to stop at that point. Although we certainly will be on the line after the WebEx if anybody thinks of any questions. So we'll just wait a minute or two if that's okay.
Certainly. To reiterate, if you need to ask a question, please press star followed by one. And we do have a question from Ms. Mary Lou Kimberly. Please go ahead.
Okay. Hello, Mary Lou.
Hi, everybody. Hi. Just checking in. It's interesting that you're doing this because we're doing our spring meeting and we had decided that the resources were really an important tool. So I don't know. We're thinking along the same lines. I think that's wonderful. I have a question, though. We've not been told exactly if the STAR website is still being supported. I've noticed that the updates are occurring, but we wanted to look at using that for a data tool for agencies for those that don't have vendor-supported graphs. Do you all know if that's going to be supported and if we should include that in this piece?
What I know, Mary Lou, and you're not going to be happy with my answer, I do not know long term.
Okay.
We will certainly do the update in June. Actually, Jill processes that update for us. But but long term, no, I don't have an answer for that.
Okay, because, we'd hate to put it out there as a continuing resource and not really have anything behind it. Mm-hmm. So, all right, well, thank you for that.
Yes, I'm sorry. That's all I have right
now. Okay. Thank
mm-hmm.
you.
That's a good question, though. Star, do we have any other questions?
We don't have any additional questions at this time.
Okay, well, if there are no further questions at this time, we will begin the WebEx. Misty, if you wanted to introduce the WebEx.
Thanks. We're just going to have Stephanie's going to be taking down the agenda from us, and she's going to be starting the WebEx. This is a, I think it's about a 30-minute WebEx. This is Dr. Carl Ohringer, and I will be doing an introduction on the WebEx. We wanted you to see some of the resources as they come out so that you'll be able to know what you're promoting as you go forward. So without ado, it's all yours, Stephanie.
Hello, welcome to the Polish Your Practice Heart Failure. Today's session is on lipid management, and we're going to be hearing from Dr. Carl Ohringer. Dr. Ohringer is an Alpha Omega Alpha graduate of the University of Miami School of Medicine, where he did his internship and residency in internal medicine at the University of Miami Affiliated Hospital. He completed his cardiology fellowship at the Peter Bent Brigham Hospital in Boston. He began his career at the Ochsner Clinic in New Orleans, where he directed the coronary care unit and the cardiac rehabilitation program. In 1986, Dr. Ohringer joined the faculty of the University of Michigan Medical Center, where he developed and directed the preventative cardiology program and was active in patient care, hyperlipidemia related to clinical research and community outreach programs directed at cardiovascular health. In 1992, he moved to Cleveland to direct the preventative cardiology program at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. Dr. Ohringer is board certified in internal medicine, cardiovascular diseases, and clinical lipidology. He is currently Clinical Associate Professor of Internal Medicine at Case Western Medical Center, where he is the clinical cardiologist and directs the Lipid Clinic and Cardiac Prevention Program. He served on the Graduate Medical Education Committee of the National Lipid Association and is also a member of the Board of Directors of the Midwest Lipid Association. Dr. Ohringer also is the editorial reviewer for American Board of Clinical Lipidology, Self-Assessment Programs, and Board Examinations, and as well as the editor reviewer for the Complex Lipid Management Self-Assessment Program. Dr. Ohringer has authored multiple peer-reviewed clinical papers, has written several book chapters, and co-authored the Grocery Shopping Guide, which is the first consumer-directed book to analyze grocery products to help the public make more informed decisions about the groceries they purchase. Now, today's session on lipid management will also go together nicely with the clinical intervention three modules from the nurse practitioner, as well as the nutritional interventions and pharmacological interventions. They're all found on MedQuick, www.medqic.org, under Home Health, under Acute Care Hospitalizations, or Disease Management. I'm now going to turn the presentation over to Dr. Ohringer.
Good to be here today, and we're going to talk today about lipid management for the prevention of coronary heart disease. Prevention of coronary heart disease is one of the key steps in preventing the development of congestive heart failure, and as such, we need to be directing our efforts to thinking of ways that we can keep our patients out of trouble before they develop the clinical syndromes of heart failure. Coronary heart disease is a leading cause of death in adults in the United States. It accounts for one-third of deaths in people older than the age of 35. 13.7 million people in the United States have diagnosed coronary heart disease, and half of these have had a heart attack, and about half have had chest pain upon exertion, which is angina pectoris. So the question is, why should we consider prevention as the first step instead of just going ahead and treating these patients for their heart failure? The fact is that the first manifestation of coronary heart disease is often a heart attack or sudden death. And heart attacks can cause major functional impairment, which can have a major impact on the individual to whom it happens, as well as to the family unit. Hospitalization is expensive and it's stressful for the patient and his family. And people with heart damage require more intensive medical care and incur higher medical costs. The major risk factors for heart attack include cigarette smoking, high blood pressure, diabetes mellitus, high blood cholesterol, and a family history of early heart disease. The more of these risk factors that an individual has, the greater that person's risk for a future coronary event. So, in consideration of the information that I've just presented, I want to review for you a challenging patient who I initially saw in 1994. This lady presented with a two-month history of chest pain upon exertion. She was 56 years old at the time. A stress test showed evidence of severely impaired blood flow to her heart, and an angiogram was recommended, but she declined angiography and initially wanted medical therapy. After 3 months of medication, she decided that she wanted to proceed ahead with the angiogram, and the angiogram demonstrated severe blockage in all of her major coronary arteries. Coronary bypass surgery had been recommended at one institution, but she wanted a trial on medical management to see whether this would help her, as she was very afraid of the idea of bypass surgery. Well, now turn the clock ahead to 2008. She was treated with medication to eliminate chest pain and to reduce the risk of a heart attack, and in fact, after about 6 years of treatment, she no longer experienced angina pectoris. Thyroid problems arose and were treated effectively. She developed some heart rhythm problems, which were also diagnosed and treated very effectively. Dietary counseling and lipid medications were employed. And her bad cholesterol, the LDL, fell from 193, its initial level, to 84, which is where it is currently. Her triglycerides fell from 296 to 125, and the good cholesterol remained unchanged at 46. The beauty of this case is that she had no heart attack, no chest pain, and no hospitalizations in the ensuing years, and in fact, she has had a completely normal quality of life. So that brings me to the issue of what are the things that we can do as clinicians to help to make a difference in our patient's risk of heart attack. And it all begins with lifestyle. The first thing that we need to discuss is eating right to protect your heart. And the steps in doing this are, first of all, to decrease the intake of saturated fats, and foods that contain high amounts of saturated fat include bacon, whole and 2% milk dairy products, cheese, ice cream, sour cream, dark meat, and the skin of poultry. In those who have elevated triglyceride levels, we also recommend that these patients not only reduce the intake of saturated fat, but also reduce the intake of simple sugars, foods like pies, cakes, candies, cookies, pastries, more than two pieces of fruit per day, fruit juice, alcohol, white flour products, white rice, white potatoes. And instead, the patient should increase the intake of water-soluble fiber, including oats, barley, dried beans, peas, apples, pears, and modest amounts of citrus fruit. We also recommend that they increase their intake of particularly ocean fish to a minimum amount of 8 ounces per week. It is recommended that these patients eat more nuts within limits, and that is generally 1/2 to 1 cup per day if additional calories are acceptable. Portion control, of course, is acceptable no matter what you eat. And then we also strongly advise our patients to avoid fast foods, since almost all fast foods are relatively high in salt and fat, and the effort should be made to minimize the intake of these foods to the greatest extent possible. There are some functional foods called plant sterols and stanols, which people can actually eat and can have significant LDL or bad cholesterol lowering effects in addition to whatever other treatments they are taking. These functional foods may reduce LDL cholesterol by 6 to 20%, and it is recommended that people who are trying to lower their cholesterol in this fashion take in 2,000 to 2,500 milligrams per day. And I've given you on this chart some commonly used foods that people can buy in the store that can help them to increase their intake of plant sterols and stanols. And the goal is to get to that 2,000 to 2,500 milligram per day amount. There doesn't seem to be benefit from eating more than 2,500 milligrams a day, and patients can easily use these foods, get the desired amounts, and get reduction in their bad cholesterol levels. So when treating lipid disorders, it's important to remember that diet, exercise, and weight reduction to as close as possible to the ideal body weight is the first step, regardless of medical therapy, and that is whether or not the physician is prescribing medication. Secondly, it's important to be sure that your doctor has excluded medical causes of cholesterol disorders. For example, as the director of the lipid clinic at University Hospital's Case Medical Center, it is not uncommon that I see several patients per year who are referred to me because of difficult-to-control cholesterol disorders, and when they have their evaluation, it turns out that they are hypothyroid. It is known, for example, that hypothyroidism is associated with elevated blood cholesterol levels, and in many cases, as the thyroid disorder is corrected, cholesterol levels may fall significantly. So it's important to consider thyroid disorders, liver or kidney disease. It's important to think about medications that can sometimes have adverse effects on the blood lipid levels. So one needs to think about any other cause for cholesterol or triglyceride disorders before just empirically treating the cholesterol or triglyceride problem. Dietary consultation is of great value and should be employed whenever possible, as registered dietitians provide a great service that many physicians are unable to provide for their patients. Medical therapy with one or more drugs is usually necessary in those cases, especially those with multiple risk factors, to achieve the National Cholesterol Education Program Adult Treatment Panel 3 goals. But cholesterol drugs are safe, especially if doctors know how to use them, and these are very, very effective drugs in reducing future cardiac risk. Now, thinking about fish, we mentioned a little while ago the importance of eating fish. I want to take a minute to talk about fish because this is something that your patients will often ask you about. Omega-3 fatty acids, which are the main fatty acids in fish, lower coronary heart disease risk by reducing blood clotting, by improving the function of the linings of the arteries, and by preventing heart rhythm disturbances. Studies of patients at high risk of heart attacks have shown significant reduction of risk when these patients eat fish on a regular basis. Women in the nurse's health study and men in the physician's health study showed reduction in heart attack risk in proportion to the amount of fish that they ate. So what you need to know about fish is that, first of all, fish is a great source of protein. It is generally low in the bad types of fat and is a great option to meat. It provides healthy fat, that is the omega-3 fatty acids. We recommend that people eat at least 8 ounces of ocean fish per week, and it's better to avoid fish that are likely to contain heavy metal contaminants, such as swordfish, tilefish, king mackerel, and shark. We also recommend eating a variety of fish, which doesn't include your favorite fast food restaurant's filet of mayonnaise sandwich. So again, I want to emphasize that fresh ocean fish is the best type to eat. Lifestyle change can also help to raise HDL, or the good cholesterol. The frequency and intensity of cardiovascular exercise determines the degree of rise in HDL cholesterol. You generally see greater increases with 5 30-minute sessions of low-intensity exercise per week than with 3 60-minute sessions. Walking seems to have little impact on HDL cholesterol, but exercise tends to work best in overweight people and in those with high triglycerides and low HDL cholesterol. 1 to 2 drinks per day of alcohol may actually raise HDL cholesterol, but there's no good evidence that increasing alcohol intake acts as an effective therapy to reduce future heart attack risk. Now, many patients require medical treatments to help to lower their blood cholesterol levels. And there are a whole host of drugs that are useful for this purpose, and there's going to be a module in this series that talks about those drugs in detail. But suffice it to say, for the purposes of our discussion today, that the drugs that are used today to treat high cholesterol can be categorized in the following way. There are drugs that reduce the production of bad cholesterol in the liver, and these are the statin drugs that so many of us are familiar with. There are drugs that reduce the absorption of cholesterol from the intestines, and these include drugs like ezetimibe, cholestyramine, cholestipol, and cholecalciferol. These are all drugs which reduce the absorption of cholesterol from the intestinal tract. There are drugs that reduce the production and increase the breakdown of triglycerides and increase the production of the good cholesterol, and these drugs include the fibrates and niacin. And then finally, there are the omega-3 fish oil capsules, which reduce the production and increase the breakdown of triglycerides. These drugs will be discussed further in other modules in this series. The key points to remember about cholesterol medications are that they are, number one, extremely safe when given as directed with proper monitoring. Secondly, they may be given as single drugs or, if necessary, in combination. Third, if side effects occur, they are generally very, very easily treated by your physician. And finally, if side effects occur with one specific medication, other cholesterol medication may be conveniently substituted and usually provides a good cholesterol-altering effect. Now, patients will often talk to you about other types of treatments that they believe are going to have a good impact in reducing future heart attack risk. For example, many will tell you that they're taking antioxidant vitamins, but in fact, vitamin C or vitamin E not only do not protect against heart attack risk, but there have been several studies to show that individuals taking vitamin E actually have an increased risk of future coronary heart disease problems. Cinnamon, while it tastes good on your applesauce, has no significant effect on blood cholesterol levels. Guguralipid, a tree resin from India, has been promoted in certain publications or in health food stores to reduce cholesterol. It does not. Polycostanol, which is alcohol derived from sugarcane wax, does not work. Flush-free niacin, which you're going to hear about when you go into the drugstore or into your health food store, provides niacin molecules which are hooked together but are not biologically active. So, in fact, even though you're giving a patient niacin, this preparation has no impact on blood lipids. Garlic, while it tastes good on your food, has no impact on cholesterol. Megadose B vitamins don't work, chelation therapy doesn't work, and coenzyme Q10 also does not work. So this is your list of things that don't help your patients to reduce their heart attack risk. Now, there are also some things that patients can purchase that are potentially dangerous. For example, red rice yeast, which does have nice cholesterol-lowering properties, is a fungus that is grown on a type of rice plant in one province in China. And while this is a naturally occurring statin, the fact of the matter is that there's no control on the amount of statin that comes in any particular batch of red rice yeast. So a patient may be getting a lot at one time and a little at another time, and there have actually been reported cases of severe kidney damage in patients receiving those batches of red rice yeast that contain too much of the active ingredient. So we strongly encourage our patients to avoid these products. Slow-release niacin, when taken in higher doses, may actually have toxic effects on the liver and should generally be avoided. It's also dangerous to take someone else's cholesterol medication because it worked for them. As you know, patients do these types of things, and you need to be sure that they are only taking the medications that they have been prescribed by their physician. It is also dangerous to continue on cholesterol medication without regular safety monitoring. While these medications are very safe, it is also recommended as part of the package insert that physicians on a routine basis check their patient's blood testing to make sure that all the safety parameters are in check. It's also potentially dangerous to be regularly followed up for your cholesterol but not be checked for your heart. Some patients go to their physician, say that their cholesterol is checked, but they never had a regular checkup of their heart. They just went in and had their cholesterol issues discussed with them. And finally, another potentially dangerous situation is to focus on your heart health but not pay attention to other important health maintenance practices such as digital rectal exams, PSA levels, regular breast and GYN exams, mammography, bone densitometry, colonoscopy, and influenza vaccination. So we need to remember that heart health is only one aspect of general health. Now, we have generally been advised by the National Cholesterol Education Program to assess coronary heart disease risk by counting traditional risk factors. The National Cholesterol Education Program Adult Treatment Panel 3 said that we should count traditional risk factors including gender, age, total cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, smoking, and systolic blood pressure. And then it is recommended that Framingham risk scoring be advocated for those patients who have two or more risk factors. Framingham risk scoring is a way of doing statistical modeling to estimate a given patient's likelihood of coronary heart disease events. And then lipid management recommendations are made based upon the principle of matching treatment intensity to the patient's estimated risk level. And it is suggested in the Adult Treatment Panel 3 guidelines that patients be treated with lipid-altering intensity in accordance with either the presence of disease or the number of risk factors they have. And as you can see from this diagram, when you look at the lower risk patient with zero or one risk factor, the LDL cholesterol goal is less than 160. Therapy with lifestyle change, therapeutic lifestyle change, or TLC, is initiated with a patient who has a total, has an LDL cholesterol of 160 or greater, and drug therapy is considered for those who have LDL cholesterol of 190 or greater. For those who have two risk factors, as you can see in the kind of second area from the bottom, those who have two risk factors and a risk less than 10% according to the Framingham guidelines or the National Cholesterol Education Program guidelines, LDL goal is less than 130, initiate therapeutic lifestyle change for LDL cholesterol greater than or equal to 130, and consider drug therapy for LDL cholesterol greater than or equal to 160. But as you move into the higher risk categories, those with two or more risk factors and a 10 to 20% risk according to Framingham risk scoring, the LDL goal becomes less than 100, initiate therapeutic lifestyle change when LDL cholesterol is 130 or greater, and consider drug therapy for LDL cholesterol greater than or equal to 130, but consider it now for LDLs of 100 to 129. In those patients who have established coronary disease or coronary risk equivalent states, including symptomatic carotid disease, that is those who have a carotid bruit or a 50% or greater stenosis in the internal carotid artery, those who have peripheral vascular occlusion disease, diabetes mellitus, or those who have abdominal aortic aneurysms, or those who, based upon Framingham risk scoring, have coronary risks of greater than 20% in 10 years, LDL goals should be less than 100 with optional goals less than 70. You initiate therapeutic lifestyle change in those who have LDL cholesterol greater than or equal to 100, and you consider drug therapy in those with LDL cholesterol are greater than or equal to 100. Finally, those patients who have had recent acute coronary syndromes or coronary heart disease with diabetes or coronary heart disease and multiple risk factors, LDL goal less than 70, initiate therapeutic lifestyle change for those with LDLs greater than 70, and consider drug therapy for those who have LDL cholesterol greater than 70. So, as you can see, the goal is to match the intensity of risk factor treatment to the disease that you have or to the anticipated assessment of the disease that you have. And in fact, we're now seeing LDL goals lowered more and more with each publication that comes out. Smith and his colleagues in Circulation of 2006 published the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology guidelines, suggesting that patients with coronary heart disease, peripheral vascular occlusive disease, atherosclerotic aortic disease like aortic aneurysms, and carotid disease should definitely have LDLs less than 100, but reasonably now you can lower their LDLs to less than 70. And the American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association joint guidelines for the management of patients with established atherosclerosis said that a multifaceted approach to coronary heart disease risk reduction is definitely warranted in higher risk patients. So the goals are, number one, with regard to smoking cessation, complete cessation from the use of tobacco. Blood pressure management, definitely less than 140 over 90 and less than 130 over 80 in patients with type 2 diabetes mellitus and chronic kidney disease. With regard to lipid management, the goal for all patients with established atherosclerosis is an LDL cholesterol less than 100, but a reasonable LDL goal less than 70, and non-HDL cholesterol, which is simply total minus HDL cholesterol, less than 100. Physical activity, 30 minutes a day, 5 days minimum. Weight management, body mass index, and there are simple charts to look at a patient's height and weight, should be 18.5 to 24.9, waist circumference less than 40 in men and less than 35 in women. diabetes management, we like to see hemoglobin A1C is less than 7. Antiplatelet and anticoagulant therapy, aspirin, 81 to 162 milligrams a day, with clopidogrel as appropriate if the patient is aspirin intolerant or if the patient has had a coronary stent. Renin-angiotensin aldosterone blockade should be considered in patients with atherosclerotic vascular disease unless otherwise contraindicated. Beta blockers post-MI in patients with acute coronary syndromes or LV dysfunction, all these patients should get beta blockers. And finally, influenza vaccination for all patients with established cardiovascular disease. Now, I want to spend just a couple of minutes on a new way of thinking about aggressive risk factor detection, because it's also important that not only that you know what is considered current thinking, but also what is on the horizon as we move ahead into 2008 and beyond. We've recognized that there are certain limitations of the National Cholesterol Education Program Adult Treatment Panel 3 guidelines, and this really entails the use of framing and heart study-based risk assessment. When you use this type of risk assessment using the Framingham Heart Study, the risk modeling is based upon a Caucasian middle-class New England population. The problem is that Framingham risk scoring overestimates risk in Japanese Americans, Native Americans, and Hispanics, and it requires the use of recalibration formulae in those individuals, and it also underestimates coronary heart disease risk in many who are considered low-risk women. So a different approach to coronary heart disease risk assessment that has been used in our medical center is cardiac CT imaging for coronary artery calcium scoring. We use this because it is, first of all, coronary calcification is only seen exclusively in those who have coronary atherosclerosis. No other conditions cause calcification of the coronary arteries. The beauty of this testing procedure is that there are no intravenous lines, no contrast. The test generally takes about 5 minutes, and there's very low radiation exposure. And there are four very compelling reasons to measure coronary artery calcium for coronary heart disease risk assessment. First of all, it definitively diagnoses and quantifies coronary atherosclerosis. It tells you whether you have the disease, and if so, how much you have. Secondly, it provides accurate prognostic information for risk of coronary heart disease death and non-fatal MI, because Framingham risk scoring accurately determines risk in about 75% of patients. The problem is that if the patient sitting across from you is one of the 25% whom it doesn't accurately assess risk, your patient's in trouble. Whereas coronary calcium scoring allows you to focus in on those who truly have disease versus those who do not. It also stratifies coronary heart disease risk at all levels of Framingham risk scoring. In other words, if you have a patient who has a Framingham risk score of 10% over the next 10 years, a high calcium score will put that patient into a higher risk category. And finally, it aids in coronary heart disease risk prediction in type 2 diabetics and in various underrepresented groups like minorities, younger patients, and females. When we think about the incremental value of coronary calcium scoring above that of just traditional Framingham risk scoring, there was a study published in JAMA in 2004 in which over 1,300 asymptomatic subjects over the age of 45 who had at least one coronary heart disease risk factor and estimated risk of coronary disease greater than 10%, meaning that they were in the intermediate risk group according to Framingham risk scoring, underwent a cardiac CT for coronary calcium scoring and were followed for a median of 7 years. This study showed that regardless of the Framingham risk score, whether it was 10 to 15%, 16 to 20%, or greater than 21% over 10 years, a coronary calcium score of greater than 300 doubled the risk of coronary heart disease death or non-fatal myocardial infarction as compared to those who had coronary calcium scores less than 300. So again, it acts to further refine our ability to predict the patient who's at risk versus the patient who is at lower risk. Coronary heart disease risk can also be better seen using coronary calcium scoring in certain presumed low-risk women. The multi-ethnic study of atherosclerosis, which was published in the Archives of Internal Medicine in 2007, studied over 3,600 asymptomatic, ethnically diverse women ages 45 to 84, for a little under 4 years, and 90% of these women were classified as low risk according to Framingham risk scoring. The prevalence of any coronary calcium was associated with a six-fold increased risk of coronary heart disease, adjusted for age, ethnicity, body mass index, LDL, high blood pressure, smoking, estrogen, and statin therapy. And when those women were found to have coronary calcium scores greater than 300, this is associated with a 6.7% absolute risk of coronary disease as compared to those with a coronary calcium score of zero, where the risk was only 0.3%. So the study concluded that the presence of coronary calcium defines a group of improperly categorized, quote, low-risk women, according to Framingham risk study criteria. Now, it is now recognized that, and there was a large paper that was published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology as well as Circulation in 2007, which showed that the estimated annual risk of coronary heart disease death or myocardial infarction in these intermediate risk populations, those who have those men over the age of 45 or women over the age of 55 who have just one additional risk factor, if their coronary calcium score is 0 to 99, they have a 0.4% annual risk of myocardial infarction or coronary death. If their calcium score is 100 to 399, the risk is 13% over 10 years. And if their coronary calcium score is greater than or equal to 400, they have a 2.4% annual risk, which is considered to be a coronary risk equivalent state. So it provides a very accurate opportunity for the clinician to provide meaningful treatment for their patient. And at University Hospital's Case Medical Center in Cleveland, Ohio, where I practice, we've developed a program called EDUCATE, which is basically a acronym for early detection using calcium scoring for the treatment and elimination of coronary artery disease. The candidates for screening for this program are men ages 45 to 74 and women ages 55 to 74 with one or more of these risk factors: cigarette smoking, arterial hypertension or taking blood pressure medication, HDL cholesterol less than 40, type 2 diabetes mellitus, or a family history of coronary heart disease in first-degree male relatives less than age 55, or first-degree female relatives less than age 65. We also consider screening men and women at younger ages when first-degree relatives have had premature coronary heart disease. And I'm not going to go through all the details of this algorithm except to say that with the LDL goals and other treatment goals going across the top of this slide and the coronary calcium scores going down the side of the slide, you'll notice that in accordance with the calcium score, we make recommendations in terms of the intensity of LDL cholesterol treatment. Note that those who have LDL cholesterol, note that those who have calcium scores of zero, we have an LDL cholesterol goal less than 130. At the bottom of the slide, those who have calcium scores greater than or equal to 400, their LDL cholesterol goal is less than 70. And we recommend other treatments, including aspirin, omega-3 fatty acids, and we give recommendations in terms of follow-up testing. So the bottom line here is that newer approaches to accurately assessing coronary heart disease risk are now being employed, and they will be employed in more and more medical centers as time goes on. One of the reasons this is working in our medical center is that we've been able to lower the cost for such calcium scoring to $99. And patients are able to afford this and to move ahead with their treatment because in many cases, patients who were thought to be at high risk turn out to be at low risk, and patients who were thought to be at low risk turn out to be at high risk. And I thought toward the end of this presentation, I would simply present a case which would give you an illustration of how this works. RT is a 57-year-old man referred for evaluation of coronary heart disease risk status. He has no angina pectoris, dyspnea, calf claudication, or history of TIA or CVA. His coronary risk factors include his having smoked up to 2.5 packs a day for 18 years, but he had not smoked over the 10 years prior to his coming in to see me. He had no history of diabetes mellitus or arterial hypertension. He had never been told that he had hypercholesterolemia, and there was no family history of premature coronary heart disease. On examination, his weight was 183 pounds. His body mass index was in a satisfactory range at 26. his blood pressure was 128 over 78, and the rest of his examination was entirely normal. His electrocardiogram was totally benign, with sinus bradycardia at a rate of 57 per minute, and otherwise was normal. And his lipid profile showed a total cholesterol 155, HDL cholesterol 35, triglycerides 95, and LDL 101. So one would say that his LDL cholesterol certainly does not look too bad, although he does have a low level of HDL cholesterol. When we used the National Cholesterol Education Program Framingham Risk Scoring to assess this patient's 10-year risk of coronary events, his age resulted in the calculation of 8 points. His total cholesterol of 155 was 0 points. His HDL cholesterol of 35 was 2 points. Systolic blood pressure of 128 was 0 points. And his smoking status, depending upon whether you consider him an active smoker or a non-smoker, because he did smoke 2 packs a day for many years, but he stopped smoking, is anywhere from 0 to 3 points. Well, his Framingham risk score, depending upon whether you give him 10 or 13 points, is either 6 or 12%. And so it was suggested by the Framingham risk scoring that his LDL cholesterol goal should be less than 130, possibly less than 100. But when we did coronary calcium scoring, his score was greater than 400, it was 438, which actually indicated that his risk was much higher, a 24% 10-year risk of a coronary event. Therefore, his LDL cholesterol goal should be less than 70. And according to the most recent guidelines of the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association, this patient should undergo stress testing to determine whether there's evidence of underlying ischemia. So, to summarize then, for lipid management in 2008, aggressively screen for risk factors for coronary heart disease. Treat the lipid goals in accordance with the risk factor status of the patient. Use lifestyle change therapy first and proceed to drug therapy when indicated according to the National Cholesterol Education Program Adult Treatment Dental 3 Guidelines. And finally, be on the lookout for refinements in risk prediction to help to more accurately determine which patients require more aggressive coronary heart disease risk factor management. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Stephanie, for providing that for us. And I hope you can really see how this will help complement some of the resources that we have out previously. And once you see the resources that we have from our nurse practitioner, Vera will be very complimentary. The pharmacological will go into more detail about the statins, and we'll go into some specific with generic and trade names and side effects and how to tips on helping to improve patient adherence, and with the fish oil, how to determine what's the correct dose and reading the labels. And then the dietitian, the professor of nutrition, is going to go into more of our diet and how we can encourage our patients in a home care setting to be more cardiac efficient with their diet. So this is just a sample. We wanted to show you the materials that we're going to be able to help provide our agencies to be able to use this very easily at a staff education. Half an hour, they can, open it up to some questions amongst themselves. We'll have some additional handouts that may accompany some of the presentations that they could pass out. Like for Vera's presentation, example would be the New York Heart Association classifications and the American Heart Association and the American Cardiology Association stages. So we have handouts for those things that will accompany these WebExes and some other resources to go along with that. So that's our presentation for today, Eve.
Yes, and I've had a couple of questions as this has been going on about the handouts. We actually just got this back. And we will, as Misty said, there will be some accompanying handouts, and we'll have the handouts in the regular format that we put them when they're posted on MedQuick. We'll keep you all updated as this resource list is updated. As you can see, it was kind of preliminary or a document in progress as far as this whole list of resources. But thank you, Misty, and this is really excellent, excellent clinical information. I can't help but think it's really taking everybody to, a higher level, good clinical information, and there's more to come. At this time, if the operator star would see if there's any additional questions.
Once again, if you have a question or a comment, please press star followed by one at this time. And we have a question from the line of Lynn Kemper. Please go ahead.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I just wanted to say thanks so much for pulling all this together. This is just incredible in terms of, as we say, a do for 3 years to folks to be able to offer this very comprehensive list of education sessions, I think is huge in trying to maintain some of our relationships as we go forward. So thank you all for putting this together.
Well, thank you, Lynn. And, you know, we want to do it. It kind of, like a lot of the things, kind of came about, an idea here, an idea there. I think it's needed. And but I appreciate the thanks, as I know Misty does also.
Yeah, well, it's a big chunk of work right here at the very, very end for you guys. So I just want you to know I think we all appreciate that. And were there handouts with today's presentation, or is that part of what you're going to be adding in later?
It will be posted. I have the handouts.
Okay.
I didn't send them. I just really wanted you to get a feel of what it is.
Yeah.
But I have, they'll be posted just like they normally will be with all of our web access.
Well, it was a great presentation. Appreciate it.
Right. He was excellent.
Yeah.
He was. But thank you, Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
Star, any other questions?
Not at this time. Please continue.
Okay. Well, that brings us to the conclusion of this call. So we'll be talking with you all soon. Certainly, if you have any questions, don't hesitate contacting us and any of us here at the Home Health Kiosk, and have a great rest of the day.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude your conference for today. Thank you for your participation and for using AT&T Executive Teleconference Service. You may now disconnect.
Thank you for calling the AT&T Teleconference Replay System.